11 o'clock hour here on WEEI. Dan Ball with you. Thanks so much for being with us. Join the conversation at 617-779-7937. Also, appreciate the clarification from the 603. He was not telling me to leave it alone when talking about the Red Sox. It's like, what am I supposed to talk about? I am not as well equipped to talk about anything more than I am the Red Sox. Like, I'll talk hockey, and we'll do that in just a few moments. But, you know, and I'll mix Patriots and Celtics in there. But if I can't talk Red Sox, I don't know what I'm doing here. I just want management to leave the team alone and let everybody play as they're doing right now. Which is, I understand that sentiment. I do. And I appreciate that much more than me having to leave it alone. But, There are things that are just naturally going to have to get sorted out. The Bregman and Yoshida things are not, that's not trades, that's not DFAs, that's not it's just guys that are coming back from injury that are major league caliber bats that can really help you extend what's been going on with this offense. As your group is ranked first, and I just saw Joe Wild tweet it. I'll actually read it on the fly, and then we'll move on. Your Red Sox offensive ranks. And again, this is cherry picking the sample size, but since June 28th, 8.7 runs per game first, 331 average first, 384 on base percentage first, 588 slugging percentage first, 86 hits first, 30 doubles first, 18% K percentage third, which is lovely. So they're striking out less and hitting the ball more. Okay. Beginning this hour with a text, not on our text line, but on my own personal phone. If you plan on talking Bruins, definitely kick to me if that is something you would be open to. I have been waiting to give my opinion for like 2 weeks on Higgins and the Bruins' weird prospect pool. That is from my good friend and producer today, Jacob Lasner. So, as we wade into the Boston Bruins' waters for a moment here on WEEI, Jacob, you have been waiting to give your opinion on James Higgins and the Bruins' quote-unquote weird prospect pool. Why don't you set the table for our Bruins conversation and tell me what you think?
So I think that it's so interesting that over these past, I want to say 5 years, the Bruins have drafted so many Boston College hockey players, and I don't think that any of them have, you know, made it into the NHL. I mean, I know Mark McLaughlin played a few games for the Bruins a few years back, but he's now gone. Trevor Kuntar, also another Bruins BC draft pick, also gone. So I wanted to rank all six of the Boston College Bruins prospects.
Okay.
So I got to start off with an unknown right now. He's a freshman, Christian Kostandinsky. He's going to be my number six.
Okay.
You know, not really sure what he brings to the table. He is definitely going to be a large project for the Bruins to develop. I'm not sure if he's ever going to see the NHL ice.
Yeah, seventh round pick in 2023 is this Kostandinsky kid. He's a Swedish kid.
Yeah, and then number five is going to make a few people angry. I'm going to have to go with Dean Letourneau as my number five.
That's my man.
That's fourth-line
center for the Eagles next year, Dean Letourneau, mind you. Go ahead.
He just looked so out of sorts, out of whack for BC. He hit a broken hand injury for most of the season, which I just find so odd. BC just has this way of hiding upper body injuries on the hockey team. I don't know, like, why, if you could have some insight on why they hide these injuries.
You cover the team. I was going to ask you, is this something that you're supposed to be saying on the radio?
I mean, well, no, they did it with Jelvik as well. He was in a sling, but they didn't make any announcements about it.
I don't know. Yeah, that seems above board. All right, who's number four?
Number four, I'm going to go with Oscar Jelvik at number four. He's a guy that I think could play in the NHL, but he's very undersized. He's got great hands. He's tried to pull off a Michigan a few times in game. So I would be excited about him if I was a Bruins fan. But again,
fifth round pick in 2021, also from Sweden.
Yeah, he'll definitely hit the ice for the Bruins at least one point in his career.
Great.
He kind of reminds me of a guy like Dan Lushmelis.
From UMass.
Yes.
He's
going to be great in the NHL once he makes it. Number three.
By the way, you're using great for a fifth round pick very liberally. I appreciate that, but I just want to make sure you know the term that you're using as you're using it. He's going to be great in the NHL when he gets there.
Not great. He's going to be serviceable in the NHL.
I'm just making sure. I just want to make sure we set the expectations appropriately because this team doesn't know how to draft.
Yes.
So I'm just making sure we set it appropriately. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, number three, I'm going to go with William Moore. Okay. He is tall. I think he's listed at 6'2", but he is incredibly skinny right now. He has to gain weight in order to play at the NHL level. Yeah. I would say the same thing for a guy like Dean Letourneau, but he has a lot of upside, you know?
Yeah.
And the only reason why I have him at three is because he needs to, you know, develop a lot more.
Sure. But the makeup is very interesting. This is the second round, the first of their two second round picks this year, Moore, out of the U.S. national program. Very, very intriguing player for sure.
Yes. And number two, I have Andre Gasso. Last season in the NCAA, he looked like a man amongst boys out there. He was just tossing the body around, and he has a great shot as well.
Yep.
He was a seventh round draft pick, but I think that he is going to be a great third line player. Great third line player.
There you go. See, there you go. All I need is context. Yeah, seventh round pick. He looks like he's developing into a bit of a diamond in the rough compared to where he was picked. Is he playing center this year? I saw some debates on whether. So it really is. It's Higgins, Gasso, Moore, Letourneau. The four Bruins draft picks are Boston College's four centers this year.
Yes.
That's out of control. And then that leaves us, of course, with number one.
Number one is James Higgins. He has everything that you'd want in a number one overall pick, except one key thing. You know what that thing is, Dan?
Size.
Well, goal scoring. I think that a lot of players have proved in the NHL that you don't have to be that tall in order to, you know, be
especially
great.
In this NHL. Yeah, for yeah, sure.
Like
for
a
sure.
guy like Goudreau, a guy like Martin Saint-Louis with the
Brad Marchand,
the coach
for
of the Canadiens,
sure.
Brad yeah. Marchand as well. So I think that James Higgins lacks a scoring touch. That it's he did score one overtime winner last year. He did bury one on a goalie that I saw in a video from Bruins prospect camp, but his shot needs so much work. It's just not even funny,
yeah.
Which is why he fell so much in the draft. He just didn't have that scoring touch. He had so many opportunities to score, and he just couldn't bury it for BC last season.
But that intrigues me because I think the jury's still out for me on whether or not he's an NHL center or an NHL wing, kind of Will Campbell-esque, where I'm not positive if he's a guard or a tackle long-term. I know that he plays center in college. The metrics in terms of, you know, winning faceoffs and stuff are the jury still out? Even if at very worst, Jacob, he ends up being a winger, a playmaking
He'll
left
be a first
wing.
Line.
Exactly. A playmaking left wing for the way David Pastrnak scores is endlessly intriguing to me. So if that's the worst case scenario for this kid, I'm in on what he brings to the table.
Yeah, I cannot believe that, you know, the Predators and the Flyers both passed on him.
Yeah.
I thought that the Islanders were going to make a trade up after they both passed, but you know, Bruins fans should be really excited about that that player, and I think that they should go watch him at BC this year if they get the chance.
100%, yeah. I mean, you can watch half the Bruins at Conti Forum when you go this year, which is great. So, Jacob, thank you for that. I appreciate you laying that out. And that tees up the conversation that I wanted to have about the Bruins leadership as a whole, because when they finally stuck their neck out and said, this is the year that we are going to begin our rebuild or our retool or whatever term you want to use for it. In the way that Don Sweeney then was aggressive, he kind of set his own market in terms of starting his trades early with the, you know, with the Brazo trade and then, you know, a few days leading into the trade deadline. I felt more confident in Don Sweeney and Cam Neely's ability to lead the Boston Bruins than I have in at least a couple of years, because I thought they finally made a definitive decision on the direction of the franchise, and they capitalized on it. They capitalized on what was a seller's market. They got good value back in all of their trades. I don't want to hear the complaints about, oh, it's a 2027 first for Marchand. He wasn't staying. He wasn't going to be a part of your plans. You wanted to go get the kid a cup. He wanted to go win a cup. He was hurt at the time, and you got what ended up being a first round draft pick for him. Even if you want to say they pushed or they lost that trade, I think you could say they won every single trade that they made. Other than that, the Frederick deal, fantastic. That contract that they just gave out to Trent Frederick in Edmonton is gross, as is the Tanner Jeannot deal, and we'll get to that. The Brandon Carlo deal. Already Toronto is now possibly looking to trade Brandon Carlo. You get a first round pick in a kid who's a prospect who is cost controlled for a couple of years. Fantastic work there. Same deal. Even the Brazo deal. I really like Kuznetsov. I think he's a fun fourth line player. I think he brings a little something to his game. So I say all of that to say, I really, really felt good about the way that Don Sweeney and Cam Neely were going about the offseason. And that was furthered by their performance in the draft. The fact that the Bruins came away with an A grade from anybody in the draft. And I know that you obviously get good marks for drafting James Higgins and just taking an obvious top five player, seventh overall. You're going to get good marks for that. But they were lauded for the pick of Moore. I really like this Cooper Simpson kid and his goal-scoring ability. Nobody knew who the hell Blanar was, but apparently he's a PJ Axelsson guy, and he was looking good in prospect camp. So I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. People were extremely high on the overall draft class that the Bruins brought in. So they did two things extremely well. They went through their rebuild at the trade deadline well. They went through the draft well. However you feel about Marco Sturm, they're not really a destination for coaches right now. So they wanted their former Bruin. They got their former Bruin. Jury's still out on whether Marco Sturm is a good head coach in the NHL or not. His hiring at least brought the PR bump that I think the Bruins were looking for. Then we get to free agency. Only five teams in hockey had more salary cap space than the Boston Bruins entering free agency. They had some internal work they had to do. They had to sign Lauri. They had to sign Geeky, Kuznetsov, a couple other guys internally they needed to sign. DiPietro, which I'm really glad they brought back. So that cost them a little bit of their money. But they still had some room to maneuver. It was a subpar free agent class. And I'll certainly give you that. A lot of other teams did their business internally. So really, you had Nikolai Ehlers and a bunch of question marks other than that. But what you ended up with at free agency, any goodwill that this leadership group built with me was thrown completely out the window. Because this was a head-scratching, confusing, frustrating performance and more of the same from a leadership group who once again does not deserve the trust that they get from Bruins fans. Jacob, is that a stretch or a hand in the air?
No, it's not a stretch. I think of two teams. I think of the Bruins and I think of the New York Islanders, and I think that those two teams were going into this offseason with so many questions, with some good players, some bad players, but the Bruins went in the completely opposite direction than the Islanders. They got slower. They got people from 2018 who would be good, but I think overall an embarrassing free agent class for the Bruins.
No question. And the part that bothers me the worst, if you just said you're signing a bunch of one-year rentals for this transition period, you're going to trade these guys at the deadline, you're going to get assets back, and you're going to go into a much stronger free agent class with the same free agent maneuverability and multiple first-round picks next year, I would have said, fine. I see the vision. I see what you're trying to do. I am on board with that. My biggest problem is that all of these guys are signed to term. You now have Tanner Janot for 5 years. You know why they signed him? Because only three players in hockey have more combined hits over the last 5 years than Tanner Janot. He goes out there, he throws the body around. He's a perfect fourth liner. So if you signed him for fourth line money, I would have said, great, fine, love it, awesome. Signed him for 5 years at $3.4 million per year. There are only three forwards. There are only three players on the Bruins that have contracts that are longer than Tanner Janot. It's Pastrnak, it's Lindholm, and now it's Morgan Geeky. He is a Bruin until 2030. Is this guy. He's a fourth liner. So you have him for 5 years. You now have Sean Corrali back for two at nearly $2 million. Mark Kastelic is here for 3 years. I know that's not a free agent signing, but 3 years at $1.5 million. Crazy. Michael Azmont, $1.45 million for 2 years. The moves that you are making, and again, you're not handing out these albatross $9.5, $10 million deals that are going to hamstring your franchise. That's not the point. The point is that you need financial flexibility moving forward in better free agent classes, and now you don't have that. And the point is, you actually, for the first time in a couple of years, have some young kids, and Jacob kind of alluded to this with his recap of the BC class, but also just a commentary on the Bruins offseason. You finally have a few young kids that are actually worth getting a little bit excited about. This was your opportunity in a year where you probably weren't going to make the playoffs and at most were going to sniff a wild card spot. This was the year to play Matt Patra and see if he's worth anything. This is the year to play Fabian Lysell and see if he's worth anything. This is the year where you play Fraser Minton, or hopefully you sign Will Zellers after his college year at North Dakota, and you figure out if these kids are worth it. Now you have 9 fourth-line players, more or less, that are going to be blocking these kids' path to the NHL. And for what? For the sake of saving your job by saying that we're more competitive in 2025 than we would have been if we didn't make these signings? If that's the reason that you signed all these fourth-liners, these guys that are going to go into the corners hard and muck it up and, you know, play big, bad Bruin hockey, if you just did that for the sake of saving your job by saying, well, hey, at least we're competitive, that's sad. That's sad, and you should have been fired in the first place. Because if Don Sweeney is making free agent decisions, feeling as though his job is on the line, then he's not the guy that should have led you into this rebuild. You should have added at the deadline, tried to go for that playoff spot, kept Marchand, and then dealt with whatever the consequences were, another first or second round exit. But you committed to the rebuild, did well in the draft, and then spent in free agency like a team that's playing in 2011 while everybody else is playing in 2025. So for once, I was actually willing and ready and able to give Cam Neely and Don Sweeney credit for the way that they were operating, giving their franchise financial flexibility, draft capital to spend, and valuing some of their young guys, and actually doing what a rebuilding and retooling team should do. But instead, you blew all of the assets you had on guys that are barely NHLers. And yeah, you'll be a couple points of a wild card spot this year because of this at a certain point. But then what happens? You get into another trade deadline where you're kind of in it, kind of not, have to kind of sell and kind of not. And then a chance to get a generational player in Gavin McKenna at the top of the draft is going to be wasted because you're going to finish like ninth or eighth, ninth in the standings, have a minuscule chance to win that. And unless Gary Bettman's feeling generous and wants to do the whole frozen envelope thing to get you Gavin McKenna, you're going to be stuck with another guy that's not as good of a player as you could have gotten because you tried to pretend that you were competitive and you weren't. And it just frustrates me so much because you were doing everything you needed to do. And at some point you just kind of panicked. And that's not the way that you go through a reload. So unfortunately, as much as I was really honestly feeling optimistic about the direction that this front office was going, they lost all that luster for me as they went through the rest of the offseason. The Patriots in their offseason, however, that gave us a lot more optimism. Apparently, some of the metrics measuring where the Patriots are going to finish in 2025 don't necessarily agree. A commentary from Mike Reese on ESPN sharing projections from the Patriots that no matter where you fall on this team and how they did this offseason, it still feels a little bit low. We'll get to that after Jacob Lasner and get you caught up on what's trending. Back here on WEEI, 617-779-7937. Catching up on the text, this is what happens when you allow the GM, this is of the Bruins, to save his job, and they gave him an extension, bull blank, with 2 exclamation points at the end, which is how you know they're really upset. That was from the 401, and I agree. I 100% agree with that sentiment. If you were allowing a general manager to save his job, but it was only apparently temporary, because the moves that were made at the deadline made it seem as though Don Sweeney was here to stay. You're not a lame duck GM is not just going to willingly enter into a rebuild, I wouldn't think. So those moves coupled with the moves at the draft suggested, oh, all right, he's here and he's actually having a pretty good offseason. But the style, the caliber of player that was brought in during free agency suggests that there is some pressure from either ownership or Cam Neely in order to compete in 2025. Because you didn't have to. That's kind of, I know that's not an overly nuanced take, but you didn't have to. You could have signed Sean Corrali or Mikey Azmon, but you didn't have to sign Tanner Janot for 5 years. You really didn't. You could have signed one of Corrali or Azmon and still rocked with essentially the group that you had. Or you could have traded Korpisalo, opened up $3 million, promoted Mike DiPietro, who had a tremendous year in the AHL last year, and maybe went a bit more aggressive in free agency. Or explored trades for players that are actually worth rooting for. I know that they're the Jason Robertson move that I was advocating for weeks on end never really materialized, not only for the Bruins, but for anybody. But that's the kind of move other teams are out here other teams with salary cap space that want to compete are out here taking advantage of the teams that don't have salary cap space. So why couldn't you have been a part of that? What, because they were trading some guys that are undersized and more offensively minded and gifted and don't necessarily play as much defense as maybe you'd want them to? Oh, God forbid. God forbid. Look at how poorly that worked with David Pastrnak when you drafted and developed and trusted a guy who doesn't play a whole lot of defense and is more just offensive-minded. God forbid. That's the one real scourge on the Bruins, is guys like Pastrnak. That's what I've always said. 617-779-7937. A note at number four from Mike Reese's weekly column, his news and notes column on ESPN about the New England Patriots. With an improved roster in the NFL's third easiest schedule based on 2024 win percentages, opponents at a 429 mark, it is a realistic expectation that the Patriots could be in the mix for a playoff spot. According to ESPN analytics, the team has a 32% chance to qualify, which is 12th in the AFC. To read the top 10, the Buffalo Bills are leading at an 81% number. Then it's the Ravens, the Chiefs, the Bengals, the Chargers, the Texans, the Broncos, the Steelers, the Dolphins, and at 37%, the Indianapolis Colts have the 10th best odds to make the playoffs ahead of the New England Patriots. That leaves the Jets, the Pats, the Browns, the Titans, the Jaguars. Did I not see the Houston Texans? I thought I did. And then you have the Raiders at the end of that as well. So though that is the caliber of team that is being touted by ESPN. This is ESPN analytics, so this is a numerical calculation. Texans, I did read them. I apologize. That is a numerical calculation of playoff odds for the teams in the AFC. And I look at that list, and sure, you're not going to rank them with the upper echelon of that group. Bills, Ravens, Chiefs, Bengals, the like, you're not there yet. People are still going to value the Steelers and Mike Tomlin and their addition of Aaron Rodgers and their perpetual 500-ness, their perpetual 9-8 recordness as better than you right now. Okay, I'll give you that. The Dolphins are on the precipice of possibly having to admit that this whole thing was a failure, fire their coach, do all that kind of stuff. But they're going to take one more kick at the can. They have been better than you in the past few years. You give them the benefit of the doubt. The Indianapolis Colts? Really? I mean, 37% versus 32% is not this huge insurmountable gap. But would you really take what the Colts are cooking right now over what the Patriots are cooking, where your quarterback competition is Daniel Jones versus Anthony Richardson? And I saw this in a, I think it was in the Globe this morning. They did their NFL bold predictions. And I believe one of them was that Daniel Jones would start more games than Anthony Richardson. I promise you, as somebody who just came from a New York radio station covering New York football for the last handful of years, that is not a compliment. Daniel Jones being your starter in 2025, say what you want to say about Drake May. At least you're not in that situation. Michael Pittman, Alec Pierce, Josh Downs, with the addition of Tyler Warren on your offense, and then Jonathan Taylor with Khalil Herbert, I forget how to say it, but as an addition in the backfield. Offensive-wise, you do have more reasons to be excited. But I don't necessarily look at that defense and take this group over what has been created by Mike Vrabel and company. I think offense, you give the advantage to the Colts. Defense, I think you give it to what's been created with the Patriots. And then it comes down to the quarterback. And between those two, I guess between those three, it would be May. But again, still, you have to see all these pieces come together. So why is it at 32%? That's more what I wanted to explore. You want to say that the Colts deserve it more than the Patriots to be in that the top 10 in terms of the odds to make the playoffs? Fine. You've seen some of these people. You're that much higher on the Colts offensive weapons than you are what's surrounding Drake May currently, that you want to give a 5% benefit of the doubt to the Indianapolis Colts. I wouldn't agree with you, but I guess I won't argue. Why is it at 32%? The questions come down to what is the upside of this offense? The defense, I think you've raised your floor up from your four wins that you had last year to my floor right now. I think I'd get you to 7. Maybe I think your defensive acquisitions raise your floor by 2 games, in my opinion. So that's 6. And I think your coaching staff upgrades get me up to 7. That's my floor for what this team is capable of. Additions just simply by the personnel that you brought in the building. The difference between when that floor of 7 games and a 9-10 win season is your offense and is Drake May. And that's why if you have people that are in your life that are telling you, I think they're going to win 7 games, I can't really be that upset at you because of that. Because yes, you've changed things, but you haven't proven anything with the additions that you've made. Stephon Diggs, we don't know what he is. Mac Hollins, unfortunately, we know exactly what he is. So your wide receiving room, yes, it's better on paper, but we still don't know. You drafted Will Campbell. On paper, the way that you have improved your offensive line is better, but we still don't know that ever-crucial left tackle position and if it's going to be able to protect Drake May appropriately. And more importantly, or not more importantly, but also just as importantly, are they going to be able to open up any bit of room for your running backs? Because I know that, you know, Ramondre Stevenson had his case of butterfingers last year. But both of the Patriots running backs, I think we're in the bottom 5. I'll widen it a bit and say bottom 10 in terms of the amount of time before contact, yards before contact, essentially, that they had to work with last year. And Drake May, despite not having a very prolific rushing season as a quarterback, was still near the top of the league in terms of scrambling. So he was being flushed out of the pocket almost immediately and forced to create with his legs by accident, and your running backs weren't getting any time. So as much as pass protection and keeping Drake upright and allowing him to go through his progressions in proper time is important, the focus and the thing that I'm watching for is we're now, you know, under 3 weeks until training camp begins. The thing that I'm really watching for is, can they buy any bit of time for the rushing offense? Because I think your wide receiving group is, I mean, it's comparatively speaking in the league, it's bad. They were ranked 31st out of 32 by Pro Football Focus. Like, that's bad. It was the Cleveland Browns at 32 and then you. You know that Hunter Henry is going to be able to produce. He'll probably be Drake's favorite target once again. But there is so much expectation, so much pressure, and so much potential if the running game can get back to a point where it can at least be, you know, league average. So all of those pieces come together as a question mark in your wide receiving room, a question mark on your offensive line, and again, improvement, but a question mark in your running back room. I argued on WEEI Afternoons this week that the player on the Patriots that has the most pressure outside of Mike Vrabel or Drake May is Ramondre Stevenson. There are plenty of other players that fit that category, but I argued, and we had 5 people, so I kind of had to pick from what was left, but I argued that it was Ramondre Stevenson because I think the amount of pressure that the running game can take off of Drake May in the passing game is significant. And you also have other running backs that are bidding for those carries and bidding for those jobs. So there's a lot of pressure, a lot of expectation, but a lot of potential. So that's kind of where you see a number at 32%. Defense raises your floor. You should not be a cellar dweller with that defense. Coaching staff raises your floor. Once again, should not be a cellar dweller. But there's a lot of things that we do not know about the offense that's going to dictate whether or not you're a playoff team. And according to the analytic approach that the ESPN analytics folks take, numerically speaking, there is not enough proof for them to believe that your offense is good enough yet in order to take that jump and be a playoff team. 617-779-7937. Before we go to break, David is in the car. Hello, David.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking the call. So, you know, I am optimistic about this team, the Patriots. I'm very optimistic about the coaching staff. You know, there's no question, there's no doubt you have a good coaching staff.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
What was lacking last year. As far as people, you know, to think and we're going to win 7, 8, 9 games. We're a playoff team right off the bat. That's very wrong to think like that, because it starts with one position that I'm still uncertain, and we need to see a lot more, and that's the quarterback to begin with.
Yeah.
Never mind everybody else.
Right.
Because your quarterback hasn't really done anything. He didn't really show us anything last year. And the way I look at it is this way. But this year, having Josh McDaniels as his offensive coordinator, he has to do better than Mac Jones did. Mac Jones had a hell of a rookie year, and we cannot deny that. After that, things went south. But he had a real good year. He broke records, whatever. He was in the playoffs. They lost in the first round, but they did make it there. So I find that Drake May has to show a lot, and then everybody else, like you've been talking about, you know, offense-wise, who do we have? Do we know Stephon Diggs is going to be good? Is he going to be able to connect well with Drake May? We don't know. Everything's up for grabs. Everything is a gambling, and we're hoping. But I think if this team gets 5 wins the first year, I think that's acceptable. To be automatically thinking like a lot of people, I talk to a lot of people, and a lot of people are like, oh, they're a playoff team. How can you say, you can't say that yet. There's no way we can say that.
Thank you, David, for the call. I think 5 wins, people would be riding in the streets. I think with all of the additions and changes and everything that you made to try to get out from under the Gerard Mayo year, and I guess by extension, the Bill Belichick era, I think 5 wins is a disaster, which is kind of funny because 7 wins doesn't seem like a whole big difference. But the conversation around this team, 7 wins versus 5 wins, is completely different. And he's right, because there are a lot of things on this offense, as we just spent a few moments talking about, and I won't relitigate this. There are a lot of things on this offense that if you had to say, will they be good or will they be bad? In 50%, like that number from ESPN analytics that we're talking about is your number. 50%, will it be better or worse than 50%? Well, I don't know how many of those elements on your offense you're saying, yeah, I'm more than 50% confident that these will be productive and these will help. And it really all does fall with the quarterback as well. We'll continue this conversation as Greg Bedard laid out the challenges and the questions in the Patriots wide receiver room. Who is in, who is out? We'll get his opinion and we'll weigh in with some of our own. Plus yours at 617-779-7937. Some more Patriots talk on the way next here on WEEI. Jacob Lasner goes, hey, Dan, we're back in a minute. And then I'm talking with Zach Coe, who's on the ones and twos for the Red Sox today. And I get back into the Marcello conversation from an hour and a half ago. And I completely do not hear dead ball, which is the most over-aggressive liner on WEEI and maybe in radio history. 617-779-7937. We'll get into more baseball talk at the top of the hour, because Bob Nightingale, and I know, take all of this with a grain of salt, trust certain sources more than others. He just put out a number of different trade rumors that we will address, some directly related to the Red Sox, some indirectly related to the conversation we had about additions earlier on in the program. While we have a moment, Greg Bedard wrote about the wide receiving decisions for the New England Patriots. Along with Mac Hollins and Kyle Williams, Bedard would be stunned if Diggs did not make the team. Diggs, Hollins, and Williams are the stone cold locks. I am, however, not guaranteeing that Diggs is on the roster, although I would put it at about 95%. My only allowance, the team isn't thrilled with Diggs for whatever reason, a legit number one becomes available and Diggs goes out in a trade for a new number one wide receiver. Long shot, but I'm not totally ruling it out. Okay, so that's a 0%. That's what that is. I appreciate leaving the door creaked open, but, well, you know, a little sliver, a little crack where you can see the light from the hallway. I appreciate that. I'm out on that. He's either making the Patriots or he's getting cut, I would have to imagine. And I don't think, unless something boat related or boat adjacent happens during training camp, I see them finding a way to make it work. The money after the first year is negligible, so you can certainly cut bait after 1 year. I think he's a means to an end. He's hopefully helping you bide the time until you either develop your number one wide receiver in Pop Douglas or Kyle Williams, or you're able to get back into free agency. And in 1 year's time, you've proven that you are a more desirable spot for top-end talent to go. Josh McDaniels and Drake May have proven that they are a duo worth wanting to play for and wanting to join. And then you can find that number one wide receiver. I think he's your stopgap, and you're hoping that the amount of security that he brought for Josh Allen in, you know, the 2018-2019 years, that time, you're hoping that he can bring that in a certain capacity to Drake May. That's what you're hoping for. So, I mean, I would be stunned if a number one wide receiver would shake loose. And I would honestly be even more stunned if a team is going to trade for Diggs after all of this. When the whole conversation, this is a Red Sox conversation we have all the time. When the whole narrative during voluntary minicamp was how upset you are and how, you know, they're having come to Jesus meetings with Diggs already. If you're 31 other teams in football, aren't you just waiting for him to get cut, shake loose? You would really give up a draft asset for him at this point in his career and after that beginning of his tenure with the Patriots? I certainly would not. I don't think the production at this point in his career is worth giving up an asset when you can just kind of wait patiently and kind of make the Patriots, you know, force their hand into doing something about it. But digressing from there, the stone cold locks, Diggs, Hollins, Williams. Onward we trudge with Bourne and Pop Douglas. Bourne and Douglas are the near locks. I think the team would listen to trade offers on Bourne, Douglas, Polk, Booty, and Baker. And in parentheses, it says good luck. I'm giving Polk another year to prove himself, but that could end quickly and he could be traded. Bedard finished by saying rookie wide receiver Efton Chisholm has a shot to make the roster as well. Chisholm makes the team, but we still need to see him in pads. If his film is good in the preseason, they might not be able to get him to the practice squad, and he might like someone else's practice squad offer, like from a West Coast team, hometown Seahawks, Rams, Chargers, 49ers, etc. So those are the opinions of Greg Bedard on the decision-making process in the Patriots wide receiving room. To me, at this point, I think I am Diggs, Hollins, Williams, Douglas, and I think in that group, I have to have a conversation about Chisholm. Because the one thing that I am trying to do more than anything else is limit Drake May's own ability to make mistakes. Jacob, you popped your head over like you have a question or a thought. Neither. Hand in the air. Just hand up accountability. Nothing. Okay. I didn't realize I was coming in with the hot takes on. I think that Efton Chisholm might make the roster.
He will.
I think he
as a special teamer.
Yeah, I think there's. I mean, that is a McDaniels and Patriots special. That is the kind of guy that they love. The guy that will do anything and play anywhere. And yes, coach, what else can I do? Like that's a staple of this team. And if he makes every single catch within two yards of the line of scrimmage, you know what I say to that? Perfect. As long as he catches the ball. If he's going to catch that ball 2 yards from the line of scrimmage and this be there for Drake to limit his own ability to get in his own head and try to play hero ball and try to be a gunslinger, if he's there just as the, hey, don't do that. Instead of just throwing it in triple coverage, just dump it off to Efton and you'll get positive yardage. I love that profile. I absolutely love that profile. And so far, you know, the amount of roster turnover you've seen, this new leadership group has shown that that loyalty is not a loyalty is not going to get in the way of them winning. The roster turnover of the 90, this is from Mike Reese, of the 90 players on the Patriots roster, only 47 were with the team last season, 52%. I see with Polk and Baker, that dropping. I don't know if we see either of them here. Between if Efton makes the roster, he's your fifth wide receiver, and you're choosing between Bourne, Booty, Polk, and Baker, neither of the last two for me are making the team. I wouldn't think. But maybe you see some kind of upside there. I don't know. I would rather just have comparatively speaking, veterans, adults, guys that have shown more flashes with Drake May as their quarterback than I would with those two. That'll wrap up our Patriots conversation because we have to get back to the Boston Red Sox in Major League Baseball. Some trade rumors floating around from Bob Nightingale of USA Today. Some directly related to the Red Sox. Some not involving the Red Sox now, but as Sam Kennedy tells us, that ownership has given them the blessing to buy at this year's trade deadline. These could be some of the pieces that you would be entertaining if you are buying in 2025. We'll lay those names out for you next.